Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find out about our events online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and you can follow the best of our discussion on Twitter with hashtag InforumSF. I'm David Ewing Duncan, author of Experimental Man and chief correspondent of Biotech Nation on public radio. We're here to talk about social networking on the brain, the neuroscience of new media. And I'm very pleased tonight to be joined by our three panelists, Adam Ghazali, Tiffany Schlein, and Josh McHugh. To my left here, Adam Ghazali is currently an associate professor of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry, as well as a director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center, both at UCSF. His research tries to understand how a brain actually ages and explores how we can improve our attention and memory abilities. And I have actually been in the MRI scanner being tested by Dr. Ghazali, which you can read about in the book, but he's doing some fascinating work. Tiffany Schlein is a filmmaker and the founder of the Webby Awards. Her most recent award-winning feature documentary is Connected, an autobiography about love, death, and technology, which discusses what it means to be connected in the 21st century, very apropos to our theme tonight. And I have seen this film. You're going to get to see a little excerpt on the reception afterwards, which I encourage you all to stay and take a peek and go see the complete film, which is in a theater near you. Josh McHugh is the CEO at Attention Span Media. Don't you love what people are working on here for our theme? Attention Span Media. It's a social media studio that builds and cultivates audiences around original and branded entertainment. Now, before we start here, I'd like to just ask you all how many people will be multitasking while we're speaking here. Okay, and for our radio audience, there were only a few timid hands that went up there. We'll see if you all stick to that. I have asked, by the way, Josh McHugh at the end here, as we close out our discussion, he's going to be checking on the tweets that are coming in about the panel. And so we will connect up social media here with real time as we speak. Anyway.
Just throw me an elbow if I'm missing anything good here.
Yeah.
I'm tweeting just through my thoughts.
There we go. You can see this is going to be a shy panel here. So I'd like to jump right into the questions and start with a rather broad question, but I think it's important to frame this. We essentially are conducting an experiment right now on planet Earth with over a billion people. The numbers rise all the time. If you include mobile phones, it's really more like 4 billion people. It's essentially pitting a wave of new technologies against or perhaps working with the human brain. And the question is whether this brain that was developed 150,000 years ago in Africa, if it's possible for what we were born with here to actually keep up with the technology. And I think it was Tiffany was telling me beforehand, it was Einstein who said, can we keep up with our technology? And let me just start maybe with Adam to my left here, who is our neuroscientist. Are our brains up to the task of keeping up with this new technology?
Well, this is a question that we're very interested in from the science perspective, and it also has great interest to the population in general. So it's an exciting time as our studies of neuroscience in the human brain actually allow us to answer questions about how we deal with our environment in such a complex way as we're discussing today. I can tell you that we are at the infancy of trying to understand this. As I know you all appreciate, the brain is an incredibly complex organ, and we understand a lot about it, but there's much more that we don't understand. And so in this domain, we're taking tentative footsteps into trying to appreciate how our brain deals with the barrage of information we expose it to in our environments and how that's changing. I can tell you that our brain is excellent at focusing. I would say that it seems to be evolved for that type of selective directed focus. We do very well at that. We do not do very well at distributing our attention incredibly broadly or dividing it. Some people consider multitasking actually a myth, and that term's been used a lot, that we don't really stream multiple sources of information that demand our resources at the same time. We see this in our own research in our lab where we study with brain recording what's occurring inside the brain while people interact with experiments that we design to challenge them and challenge their attention and challenge their memory. And we see that when we do that, people tend to switch between the tasks. We could see it in their brain, in the connectivity in their brain, as opposed to holding attention. And when you do that, when you switch, there's a cost. Your performance drops almost routinely when you move off task and have to come back. There's a time delay, and there's also often a loss of information. So we don't study it in the pure social networking context, but we do study memory experiments where we give little pieces of information that in a lot of ways might as well be checking your email or getting a tweet or texting someone, and then what happens in your brain is you try to get back on task. So I could tell you from that perspective that there's a lot of challenges that we deliver to our brain when we try to interact in that sort of very fleeting way and very transient way of holding on to something.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about the multitasking tests and also how I did. But okay. Anyway, Tiffany.
Well, I read the...
No, we weren't going to talk
well,
about
there was,
that.
I have a section in the film about the brain and technology, and there was this fact that when you're multitasking, your IQ lowers 10 points, which is the equivalent of being stoned when you're multitasking.
Or drunk.
But I, even as we're sitting here, when you said, you know, turn off your devices, I know sometimes I go to talks to let my mind wander. I mean, you guys aren't looking at your devices, but I'm sure things we're saying is making your mind think about things. Like, you're not all sitting and listening to every word we're saying. Your mind is going in tons of directions as we're talking. So I kind of think that we, you know, and my father was, Leonard Schlein wrote a lot about the brain and brought a brain to school when I was growing up. So I've like grown up with the brain in my life. But I used to watch him do surgery and he was like myopically focused. And, you know, for 8 hours, he would just look and be like scalpel. I mean, they told a lot of dirty jokes in the operating room. But in between that, they were very focused on surgery. And I think about the way I work and I have like, you know, I have my internet browser open. I've got my cell phone on my phone and Twitter and Facebook and email. And I'm like, sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so distracted. But sometimes I also think maybe we finally created a work environment that mirrors our stream of consciousness because we don't think in a linear way. We are constantly thinking of different things. And now we have these tools to activate those thoughts. So I really toggle back and forth between we have evolved in a way that is creating this environment for our mind that's more like a stream of consciousness than a focused 8-hour surgery. And there's probably value in both.
So in some ways the technology is adapting to us maybe, or we're adapting.
I sometimes think
us?
What comes first? Is it us, you know, have we evolved to create these tools that more mirror how we really think? Or is it the other way around?
Yeah. I would say that possibly the most attention-destroying technology that is that has been invented is the tabbed browser.
Yes, totally. I'm like, I look for one thing and then I'm like, yeah. I'm down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, I've recently been experimenting at the urging of my colleagues with going with one tab at a time for extended periods because I mean there is the
<That's> so true.
the phenomenon of flow, right? That continuous stream of attention that people experience when you know that feeling that they experience when they get into a process or a creative endeavor that people seem to also associate with doing really good stuff that just doesn't seem to happen when you're toggling back and forth between 40 browser tabs. So
yeah, in fact, you know, you read studies about when you get a good email that comes in or you know, a tweet or something, there's a little dopamine that fires in your brain, and we're maybe, at least some of us, potentially getting addicted to that kind of little short-term pop, which may be behind some of the criticism of social media that it's, you know, causing us not to concentrate as much. I mean, Adam, what is that true? Do you get a little pop of dopamine, or what happens in the brain when you get that email and you go, ooh, I love that email. Bring it on. Bring me more.
Well, I was interested in that question because in addition to looking at the impact of it, I'm interested in the fact that we do it so much, especially as the awareness that it has a negative impact on a lot of our highest level performance when you want to have high level performance. You might not always want to, but when you do, it's certainly disruptive and we appreciate that, but yet we still do it. So it certainly has the ring of an addiction in that. It's something that you do that you know is negatively affecting you, but you do it anyway. And so that's like one of the hallmarks. And so I did a detailed search in the scientific literature on PubMed, and I couldn't find any study that actually directly spoke to that. But it makes sense.
It's an urban legend then?
No, it makes sense from...
What about Dr. Love?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense from
Stanford professor.
Yeah, it makes sense from the point of view of what type of interactions with the environment stimulate the reward system, which is largely dopaminergic. And we are certainly novelty-seeking creatures, and we are definitely evolved for that. We seek something out, but we do switch, and that novelty allows us to explore our environments and has survival advantages. And part of one of the things that helped perpetuate that is this satisfying reward that you feel. And one could say that the novelty load is higher when you're flittering between multiple tasks than when you're sustaining. So I think that that is part of it, and I think it makes sense. I would love to do that study. It's a challenging study to record dopamine levels in that type of really dynamic way as people are changing. But,
I mean, Tiffany, do you have trouble?
Well, in the film, there is a neurologist who's doing studies in both oxytocin and dopamine, and I love these facts. His work we kind of played with in the film, which was that, you know, you are getting this hit in email and tweets of oxytocin. But then the other study from, it was like the University of London about dopamine, because dopamine's, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's like makes you want more and more and more. And that when you're seeking information, that you know when you're late at night and you're like, God, I should really go to bed, and it's 9 o'clock and you're at your computer at 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock and you can't pull yourself away from seeking because you get into something called an infinite dopamine loop where you can't get satiated. You just can't stop, you know, seeking information. And humans are such curious creatures that I love this idea that the internet is providing this like constant state of an infinite dopamine loop where we just can't.
Remember when we used to surf? Remember that was, you're 3 in the morning. And so how did it get to be 3 in the morning when the internet first showed up and you could actually look up things? And,
yeah.
You know, now it's almost a burden. But Josh, you actually are in the business of wanting that little dopamine hit. You have clients
delivering
who want
that. Yes,
yeah, you
exactly.
Deliver that. So.
It's a little bit sinister. And the only thing that gets in the way of me and my team distributing that dopamine to the
masses.
Highly targeted masses, if that's possible, is the fact that in order to do the administration of our clients' Facebook pages and Twitter accounts, we have to wade through the first layer of the Facebook sign-in process, which is seeing your own personal friends and notifications. And it takes an iron will to actually make it through that into what you're being paid to
this
do.
This is why you call it attention span.
We do it. It's a job. It's
referring to your attention span.
Exactly.
You brought up an interesting point. We're speaking about the sort of pleasurable feeling you get when you switch on to the task and you see you got a message or you are quoted or someone referred to you. But there is a pleasure that can come with sustaining attention too. And I think about this a lot. It's harder to get there. It's sort of how like runners describe that they get that runner's high, but after they've suffered for so long to get far enough that they enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to like get over that period of time where it's not fun, and then you could reach a different type of pleasure, I think. And I worry that children especially that are not allowing themselves to sustain their attention for long enough to realize that wow, I just read for 20 minutes without stopping, and it feels pretty good, might not know it and not develop sort of the cognitive style where they allow themselves to immerse enough to find pleasure in that type of activity.
You know, my family, we were wired to the hilt all the time, and about 8 months ago, you know, I called a family meeting kind of and said we have to unplug one day a week because my brain was hurting at night. Literally, I would go to bed and have really racy, like my mind couldn't relax. I was just on all the time. I was emailing in my dreams. And
racy emails?
Anyways, so we decided as a family to unplug, do a technology Shabbat one day a week. And it's totally changed our lives. So we always celebrated Shabbat, but it was usually just a nice meal on Friday night. It's the Jewish tradition. Now lights go down. We turn off all screens, cell phone, TV, laptop for 24 hours because I wanted our children. I felt like even as a mother, like, you know, while the internet was the tool the feminist movement always needed, like it was too blurry. It was just always there. And so on the weekends, we are completely an unplugged family, which has totally been life-changing. And then, you know, we are very present. We're together. We read, we garden, we hang out in a very different way. And then Saturday night, we can't wait to go back on. And you kind of reappreciate technology in a new way, too, because it's amazing to be able to act on every single thought you have. And on Saturdays, you have a thought and you have to just sit with it. It's so weird. You're like, wow, I'm going to have this thought and I cannot tell anyone about it. I can't do anything about it. I'm just going to just sit with it.
So if you email Tiffany on Saturday,
you do not get a response.
You won't get a response back until Sunday. That actually brings up some statistics I looked up about how much time we spend on media. And apparently, just since 1999, and the latest number here is 2009, we've increased our time on media by almost 3 hours. And in 1999, it was seven hours, 29 minutes a day. I'm sorry, this is for children between 8 and 18.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
And, yeah, have you seen this?
Yeah. Yeah, Kaiser Family.
And close, yeah, 1999, close to half of that was TV. And curiously enough, over the time period that you're looking at, as you look at each year, the TV stays fairly, you know, almost the same, but you're adding, you know, we have new technologies that have been added since then. So this is computers, gaming, audio as well. It is now an astonishing 10 hours and 45 minutes a day. That's in 2009 for children between 8 and 18. I mean, there isn't that much time left in the day. I mean, what do you all make of this? Is this a horror show, or is this something that...
I want to know what they're doing with the rest of that time.
Why aren't they paying attention
exactly.
to your message?
Why aren't they on Twitter?
The interesting thing about that study, if it's the Kaiser Family Foundation report, is that they did that study, at least this is the anecdote I heard, and they were shocked to find not just what you described, but that how much of that time on media was multitasking media. So they went back and they did a whole report just on that. They realized that it deserved, and you could find these.
I've got that here, actually. It's doubled in those 10 years.
I don't know, but you know, okay, when I was growing up, okay, what was the really big concern back then? You know, my parents were divorced, so I would come home to a house that, you know, my mom went back to work. I would watch hours and hours and hours of Three's Company, Love Boat, Gilligan's Island, trashy, trashy television that I would just, like, veg out to after school.
But that was great.
But everyone thought back then that my brain was going to turn to mush.
Well, maybe we just...
My brain didn't turn to mush.
We didn't have enough technologies. Would you have watched 10 hours of Gilligan's Island?
I don't know. I guess I just feel like every era has a big hand-wringing, and I just believe in humans. I believe we're evolving. I believe every one of these new technologies, there's good and there's bad and there's hope. And these kind of conversations are really, and one of the reasons I wanted to make Connected was we're moving too quickly. I wanted people to watch a movie and made them stop and have a conversation with their family and their friends about what does it mean to be connected? What's the good, what's the bad, and the hope? But ever since the beginning of time, a new media has disrupted things, and everyone has worried that that thing was going to destroy our brains.
In fact, if you read Nicholas Carr's essay in Atlantic on his Google Making It Stupid, which is mostly, obviously, a kind of rant against media, he did make an interesting point, which is even long ago, there were new technologies that the powers that be and the establishment and others, older people in other words, got upset about. And he mentioned that Socrates railed against a brand new invention back in ancient Greece, which was writing.
And that we are going to lose.
It was destroying the oral tradition. You know, young men, only talked about men then, but young people would not be thinking, you know, the way that they'd had in the past. So clearly this is not new in the sense of a new technology, but I think it's supercharged, and that's one of the issues, is how much can, that must go back to the original question, how much can our brains really absorb here? And actually, Josh, let me ask you from the fire hose perspective, which is another interesting question here. All of the information coming out, you're a journalist, I'm a journalist, I get inundated every day. There's no way I could possibly read even a fraction of some of the information coming in.
Right.
Is this something that our brains can handle? Or can you handle? Can your brain handle?
Yeah, well, I don't think that the brain is used to, is built necessarily to handle the same amount of data coming from that many additional sources, if you compare now to 10 years ago. But the advantage you have is your friends are filtering all that stuff for you. So rather than sort of being a mark for, whatever marketer happens to have the most money to push their message to you, they now have to get through this amazing filter that is created by the people that you know and respect. And so in that sense, I think that social networking has taken a great burden off of the brain because it's distributed that burden to all of your friends.
Do you agree with that, Adam?
I think it's interesting. I feel like sometimes I get pigeonholed into the person that hates multitasking. I actually gave a talk. I was overseas, I was far away from home, and I was introduced as the person that hates multitasking. And I was like, I love multitasking.
I happen to know that you do multitask.
I do multitask. I mean, so I agree. I think that, maybe like a larger framework of my perspective of this is that it's not a good or bad thing. To me, it's a choice and decision thing, that there are times that multitasking is entirely appropriate and probably the best way that you can get through a series of boring tasks that don't really demand high quality. I basically allocate a period of time and say, I'm just going to be multitasking for the next 2 hours with the low...
No guilt.
Just enjoy it because it's more fun and you roll through it and you don't feel guilty about it, you just enjoy it. And then I'm like, okay, now for the next 3 hours as I write this grant proposal that's due tomorrow, this is where I quick my email, close my door, turn off my cell phone and actually sustain attention. Yeah. So I think it's more about... there are advantages, there are tons of benefits to social media and to the technology and multitasking in general. You just have to be able to make choices that maybe I don't have to use all my devices at one time today or even right now. So at least that's personally how I've managed it, is not create a, black and white picture of it, but it's gray and, make the decisions based on your life and what your goals are.
Yeah, and there are off buttons. I mean, I hope there will always be off buttons.
I think people forget that.
Well, I think that's why the technology Shabbats, whenever I bring it up, no one else does it. Like, I ask people, here, does anyone unplug one day a week? Two hands?
We have,
I'm telling people. I speak a lot for the film, and usually it's one or two hands. And everyone goes, you mean you can do that?
Yeah, it makes me uncomfortable even hearing you say that.
Yeah, and it has changed my life for the better in the most beautiful way, to put a real boundary. No one is going to, you have to call me the old fashioned, we have to make plans beforehand, I pull out maps, I've taught my kids maps, it's kind of fun. This is the challenge, no technology for a day, and it's beautiful. It's not like we drive a car, we use a landline, it's no screens, no things that, what I was going to say, I was at this conference that you would have loved called The Future of Science last week, and this one scientist has said, no real science can happen if you're not focused. And he was over 50. And this younger scientist said, that's absolutely not true. My best idea comes when I'm being bombarded by Twitter and all these new ideas, and a new idea comes. And it was so amazing to just see this divide in just the way that people think. Because under a certain age, the multitasking issue is not going to be a question, is the way that they breathe. One of my favorite stories about Einstein, that kind of relates to this, I think, is that he was being interviewed by a reporter, and the reporter said, you know, Professor Einstein, if I have any follow-up questions, can I call you? And he said, sure, and he went over to his bookcase, and he pulled out the phone book, and he looked up Einstein. And the reporter said, you're the smartest man in the 20th century. How come you don't know your own telephone number? And he's like, why fill my mind with such useless information if I know where I can find it? And I thought, is that how he was able to come up with the theory of relativity?
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't trying to hold on to anything. And he could have his thought experiments because his mind was, like, floating around on interesting things without trying to grasp facts and data that used to be considered intelligence.
Well, just a comment on the point, especially the point right before the Einstein reference was, you know, when I heard you say that, I was like, wow, that's, to me, it's sort of obvious. Like, both those people are totally correct.
They're both right.
They're both right. And it's the same sort of point I was making before is that, you know, of course you need to have freedom to think creatively and to make connections. And the more you can search different pockets of information, the more likely you are to see those connections and build something revolutionary. But if you can't focus, you're just a dreamer, right? That's not going to actually do anything or change the world. So you need a little bit of both, I think, and you need to know how to regulate that.
I'm not really sure. I mean, the human brain has always had to deal with lots of input at times. I mean, even in the veldt, you know, if you're running, being chased by an animal, I mean, you've got to, that's what we developed. I mean, curiously enough, we seem to have been able to adapt to.
Yeah, I think we've just gotten really good at making our ability to expose ourselves to lots of information even easier. So, you know, I mean, even you could just feel it in your own lifetime, like before cell phones. It was just, there was lots of times that there was just nothing else to do but sit there. And now that's never an option anymore. You can't even wait online at a cash register and not check your email. I mean, at least I pull out my phone.
And I forgot my phone the other day.
Oh, that's horrible.
And I felt like I felt the first panic, and then I felt like I was playing hooky.
Oh, yeah, I go home. It's
like, wow, there are people.
The initial itch, it's great.
Yeah, there are people emailing me right now, and I don't even know, and they don't know that I don't know.
That's the problem, that they don't know that you're not on.
Yeah, well, that's a problem, too.
People are getting angry at you because they think you're blowing them off.
Expectations is a big part of
that. Auto-response. Like, during the whole theatrical tour for the film, I put on an auto-response. I was like, I'm really busy. And it's so liberating to just say, I'm not going to be able to get back to you till November. And I did this 2 months ago. And now I am 3,000 emails behind. I don't quite know what to do.
See,
but
this is the problem. They don't stop coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Who here checks emails on vacation? Anyone?
Everybody. It's horrible.
A large number of people.
Talk about turning off on Saturdays. You know, here you are on vacation and you're checking your emails. What is?
Yep, but you have friends
coming
in.
Vacations of the future will be not wireless.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's funny how we keep dropping back into multitasking. It's interesting. I want to talk a little bit, though, about the real reason that this technology came about was to augment our ability to be able to interact, to bring in more information. I mean, even like Einstein, you know, he had a pencil and pen. He could write down the phone number so he didn't have to remember it. I mean, that was really the point of much of this technology, was to augment our brains, you know, to make us more effective. Do you guys think that that's exactly what's happened? I mean, has Google made us more efficient, or as Nicholas Carr said, has it made us more stupid?
I think there are a couple different things here that are part of that question. One is the availability of information, which is, you know, almost limitless now, and the other is the trigger that gets you to leave one piece of information or one line of inquiry and go toward another. So, I mean, I've definitely learned more about a lot of esoteric subjects than I ever wanted to or needed to, just, you know, by looking for something that I actually needed on Google and ended up 20 screens away. But, yeah, I mean, I think the key here is focus, is really, you know, the ability to marshal your own mind. But there's also the fact that, you know, what we're talking about is there is some documented reward for finding new information, right? But then there's also the reward you get when you know someone cares or is paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's like, are we addicted to the devices or are we addicted to connecting? Like connecting emotionally. I mean, that's what it's all really about.
I want to get to that in a second, but let's talk for a minute about, you know, I mean, we invented things like even glasses and hearing aids. I mean, these are all things to augment you know, the natural senses and brain that we have. I mean, I personally, I'll answer my own question. I love Google as a journalist. I use, you know, I'm old enough to remember when you had to go to the library and use microfiche. And, oh, my God, am I ever going to find that? You know, oh, I had the wrong reel again. You know, you spend hours. And, you know, my first three or four books I wrote in the stacks in various libraries. And you had to get permission. You had to go down and rummage around. You felt like a mole for days on end. And now you can sit anywhere, you know, on vacation if you want, and you can access that information. I think that's fabulous.
But I would say that while it is great to know the sort of the stuff that you feel like I should know that, but I don't, and that stuff is great for Google, but I've found that a real secret weapon for journalists is going to the library, because now no one goes to the library. So it's
a lot of information. Everyone's
just looking at Wikipedia now. And if you can go and actually crack up, you know, find a book from 20 years ago, nobody else has.
You
that.
Have to be very, very selective on what you use online. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And so like a counter argument to what you said, which I don't know if I fully believe, but I think it would be very hard to get data on it. Would be that yes, you have more accessibility to information, which is clearly fabulous. But does that lead you to actually hold less information in your mind? Which might be fine for a phone number, but maybe not fine for other things. That it would be, maybe you're missing making that really important connection because it's sitting in Google and not in your mind. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it would be very challenging to look at information content that we're storing and see how it's changed with changes in technology. But it's interesting to speculate that might be the trade-off, that we have sort of offloaded a lot of our long-term memory to digital format, and maybe we pay a little bit of a price for that in not, you know, making those connections internally.
Yeah, I think it's important. Tiffany?
I think that's a great point. And but, sometimes Matt Ridley's book, The Rational Optimist, where that throughout history, innovation always happened in cities because there was more minds, brains bumping into each other from different perspectives, so new ideas always came in cities. So I think, well, has the internet created this global framework for all these brains to bump into each other and all these ideas to cross-pollinate, and we're going to have innovation like we've never seen before coming up? Like, we're still in the social phase of the web. I feel like we're still in the primordial soup of social, and that the next phase is going to be collaborative. And when we really start cross-pollinating ideas, then I think it's not just about our minds. It is about the collective minds, not thinking as one, which I hate. Whenever that global mind comes into play, it sounds like this one mind thinking, and that's never what it means. It's that the diversity of perspectives and ideas create all these new ideas we can't even imagine.
Yeah, and in fact, let me, in our little bit of time remaining here, move on to the subject you all were starting to talk about, which is friends and, you know, how we manage social relationships. And in fact, when I'm on Facebook, I've experimented with this. I put down, I read this really great intellectual article, and I'd love for everybody to read it. You know, I get a couple of people liking it. I say, I just, you know, I'm sitting on a beach in San Diego, you know, sipping a beer, and it's like 10 people. Oh, great! Wow, cool.
That's funny.
It does make you sort of wonder, will we ever evolve from where we are right now?
Hope.
But I took the liberty, and I asked our panel beforehand for their permission. I'm not going to tell you exactly how many friends each of us have, but I will say Tiffany is number one, and way down below is Josh, David, and Adam. Adam actually, and again, I asked him beforehand if he was okay with this. He is just barely fourth place here on the panel. And I'm bringing that up because there have been some studies that have suggested that brain density is linked to, I'm not even sure what that means. Maybe you can explain it, to the number of friends that you have. And the study I read suggests that, your ability to have these wide social networks seems to make you more intelligent. Maybe you could tell us. And, of course,
I no longer feel qualified to even answer that.
Okay, actually, let's have to. Here's our MD, our brilliant scientist here.
Yeah, so there's a study that just came out. I just read it the other day in preparation for this talk today, that they looked at MRI scans and did a correlation across the 125 people in the study of their brain volumes and densities in different regions and how it correlated with the number of friends they had by just going in and looking online at how many friends they had in Facebook. And several areas of the brain, including areas involved in memory like the entorhinal cortex and an area involved in emotional processing like the amygdala, were correlated, that these areas were larger or more dense when you, in those individuals that had more friends. You know, it's really hard to know what to do with data like that. There's a lot of data like that out there that has question marks next to it. And I think the study was well done. I know the authors. I'm not certainly knocking that. But, you know, it's correlational data. And you wonder what it means. This obviously, the most obvious aspect is that there's a massive chicken and egg problem, is that do people that have more highly developed areas in this way, are they the ones that tend to have more friends? They actually even present the paper from that perspective, and not that actually having more friends makes these areas larger or more dense. And that's a possibility also.
Yeah, that was the biggest question I had. Is it actually possible that going online and building up a huge number of friends is changing the structure of your brain?
I would say yes, it's certainly possible. I mean, everything you do changes your brain in some way, whether or not it's going to be, I mean, that's how we learn, that's how our brains work, that's plasticity. It's a very
so you can watch this over time when you're studying
Whether or not it's going to be macroscopic or large enough to pick up with our devices is another question. Mm-hmm. But that's how your brain works. Your brain is constantly remodeling itself structurally functionally.
But how do you, I mean, just through your work, I mean, I heard you, David, saying that you're watching the brain age. So are you seeing that people that are aging and more active online, do you do any studies that kind of looks to if you're more active, that is kind of good for the plasticity of the brain? Or?
In general studies, we haven't done them in our labs, but in general studies that look at very stimulating environments show that there's lots of advantages on brain growth. I actually gave a lecture right in this room not very long ago on neuroplasticity and all the things that change the structure of our brain, including things like meditation, video games, any deep way that you can engage in your environment, learning a language, music, all these things have been documented to change not just the function, but the structure of the brain. So, yes, so I would answer that could happen. I would think it's more likely that it's all the host of activities that go along with collecting a lot of friends that are leading to those, that are associated with those changes. You know, there's millions of co-varying factors. Someone that has thousands of friends might also do, you know, and this correlation was part of that study, they also have larger real-world social networks, too. So they have more interactions, they're constantly reading emotions more frequently. So, you know, there's many factors. So it's very hard from a study like that to say it is this that's related to that. A, it's correlational, and B, it's only one of the many covariates that could be accounting for that.
Let me invite the audience. In just 3 or 4 minutes here, we're going to start the question session. So what I need you to do is walk up to the mics and start lining up there as we finish up here. Let me ask, is it possible to have 5,000 friends? I mean, there have been studies that have been done for several decades that our real friends, the circle of friends that most people can have, the maximum is around 150. And what does it mean to have 3,000 or 5,000 or even 1,000 friends on Facebook? I mean, do you know all your friends?
I have not personally met every single person that I'm friends with on Facebook, and certainly not on Twitter. That's one of the nice things about Twitter, is that you don't have that burden even of suggesting that you actually know them. But it's interesting that that's what Facebook kind of tries to figure out, too. They have this thing called EdgeRank that determines what you see in your news feed. And so Facebook actually may know the answer to this. You know, below a certain edge rank, that person is not a real friend. But that's determined by the amount of times that you interact with that person. So they know.
And Josh, are you checking tweets?
My phone's been buzzing, but I'm too focused on this event to multitask. So.
All right, so you can't move back and forth, but I have seen people tweeting out there, so there must be something going on in social media here even as we speak. Tiffany, what about the friends or even,
well, I mean, I think
you know,
the
how
terms
you handle,
friend, like, they're so binary, but there's such a range. I mean, whenever this argument comes up, I mean, as a documentary filmmaker, you know, are these people have seen my other films, or they're in, you know, are they friends, like people I would have dinner with that I invite to, you know, I think it's just, there's the broad connections and there's deep connections, and they're both valuable. So someone that's making a documentary, like on our Facebook page for Connected the Film, it's been so exciting as a filmmaker. There's 10,000 people that have seen the movie that are posting articles every day, talking about, continuing the conversation onto this Facebook page. So that's super exciting. Are they my friends? They're my community for this film. So I think, you know, you have your core friends and your core family. And then you have these new kinds of connections. Like there's someone here tonight that I met over Twitter, and we've become friends because they say, you know, Facebook is who you went to school with and Twitter's who you wish you went to school with. Because, you know, it's like you follow people that you find interesting and you meet them, and then you're like, you're friends in a new kind of way.
Yeah.
So I think there needs to be new terminology, because you're right. The 150 number was for an old definition of what a network and a friend was, and there's lots of new networks existing today.
And I think we all have layers of friends. In fact, Facebook even has its acquaintances, so they're different
yeah.
categories. Even.
Yeah.
Let me just ask real quickly. There's so many things that we didn't have time to get to, but just as we're closing out here, how social media is being used as in a democracy, and you know the political implications of this. I mean, you know, Barack Obama used it to great effect in 2008. Is this changing how we communicate as a community? And let's really have a very brief time if anybody wants to tackle that one.
It's a yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the nice things about it is that social media can cut out a lot of the steps between you and someone who cares about the same topic.
Yeah.
Right? So someone who feels strongly about a thing that not one person that you are sort of, you know, real life friends with, you can find them very quickly, and you can all, you know, you can have an instant community of interest.
Yeah.
So I think that's changing a lot, and it's also, you know, especially Twitter is enabling people to collaborate and get things done on the political front with a speed that wasn't possible before.
Yeah, and we can continue this conversation on Twitter, right? As we
absolutely
move
Inform
so,
SF.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Social Networking on the Brain. I'm David Ewing Duncan, author of Experimental Man. Now, why don't we start over on the right-hand side here with questions. Please keep them brief.
Okay. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'd like to thank Tiffany. We went down to Los Angeles when our son, Douglas Campbell, previewed your film. And I'd like to thank my husband, who's 93, sitting in the audience today, who sent a text message to one of the children. They couldn't believe it was their first text message from a 93-year-old. But, doctor, this is directed to you. Doesn't social networking minimalize our emotions to each other?
Wow. I think that it's a different type of way of interacting. You know, I mean, you all experience it every time you send a text message and it was totally misinterpreted. And so you can't get the depth of an interaction that you can face to face. This is actually a very serious concern among scholars that study children and development, that the lack of, especially like tweens and teens, and the lack of face-to-face communication and body language, which are just not there in online friendships, could have big ramifications for development and how they interact in the workplace or with people in the real world. So I think it's a really different type of interacting. I mean, in some ways, there's pluses. It makes you potentially be a little bit more thoughtful about how you phrase something, knowing that it can be misinterpreted without your facial expression at the end. So I think it's different, but it's a reasonable thing to think about.
Thank you. The left side?
Yeah. If a study attention span is about 20 minutes, and you can somehow get a positive reinforcement for that type of behavior rather than the increasing number of hours on or in media, wouldn't that help against attention deficit disorder?
You're saying that if you can sustain your attention and get that valuable feeling
for the 20 minutes of a study time.
Yeah, I mean, the essence of the problem from things like when you have attention deficit disorder is that you just really can't do that. So that's what we're trying to understand more and more, not just in children with ADHD, but adults and older adults, which is the focus of a lot of my research, are very susceptible to these inability to sustain and not be distracted by irrelevant information. But yeah, that's the goal. I mean, that's an interesting point, that if you can teach someone or allow them to get to that level where they start getting that positive feedback, it should also have this type of facilitating and reinforcing effect.
Over here, another question.
What gender differences are you seeing in use of social media, response to it, effect of it, or anything?
Anybody want to, Adam, you're...
Is anyone studying?
Anybody want to talk about that?
Well, I think the web and technology is just like the perfect medium for women, because, you know, the web is a lot about sharing. And, you know, I'll go to a dinner party, and I'll sit with a woman for 20 minutes, and I'll come back to my husband, like, she's getting a divorce. And my husband's like, you were just with her for 20 minutes. And I'm like, that's what women do. We go right on in, right? So the web, Facebook, when you share that you were on the beach, you're sharing empathy, sharing experiences. It is all about relationships and sharing, which women are really, really good at. So I'm hopeful that this is a fantastic medium for women.
Okay.
Picking up on the last two ladies over here, I recently had two 16-year-old girls, my niece and her friend, staying with me, and they were talking the whole time, texting and on the computer with two guys that they were dating, and it was the most inane conversation. It went on to 20 hours a day. They stayed up till 4 in the morning, etc. Nothing interesting said, and you've talked about older people.
It was to them.
It was, but if a guy didn't respond in 5 minutes, they were no longer the boyfriend. It was because, where is he? Why is
Wait,
he
can I ask you a question? Were you comfortable as a teenager? I mean, did you
yes.
feel?
Yes,
I hated being a teenager. It was such an awkward time.
Well, I had a lot of friends and got my moral support and their nonverbal communication as well as their verbal. So I'm wondering, what kind of decision making is this going to have on people in the future when they go even more into being told how to think and the games to play? Are they going to be able to think and decide things in a rational fashion?
I think this falls under we've been there before, really, answer to that in a way. I mean, when I was a kid, you spent time on the phone. My parents were always saying, get off the phone. And, you know, if I had a friend or especially a girlfriend, you know, you spoke inanities pretty much as, my only problem now is that my kids, it takes almost as long to text as it is to pick up the phone and actually have a conversation. That's the part I don't really get.
I think the most troubling descriptions I heard were kids on their breaks from class, when they go outside, go to like opposite sides of the playground and then text each other. And that tells you a lot, right? It's not out of necessity. It's not like calling someone. It's that it's a different way of communicating. And that's fine, especially someone that feels awkward that might not feel as capable of having a face-to-face. But it is a danger in that part of growing up is just being uncomfortable and getting through it and figuring out how to get through it. And if you have that escape, it could be a problem. At least it's something to think about.
Yeah. Another question?
So what I see is that we have a very finite 24 hours in the day. And we have this ever-increasing forms of media and virtually unlimited access to a huge amount of information on Google and on Wikipedia. And it's kind of like a round hole in a square peg can't quite resolve. There's just so much. And I only see it getting more intense. And that dichotomy of how can we fit more into this 24 hours without having to, you know, give up 100% of our sleep. I mean, we mostly really need like 3 or 4 or 5 hours, most of us. So, I just see the problem getting more and more intense, and I'm wondering if anyone on the panel might have some comments about how we can resolve that.
Sure. I would just say lean on your friends online rather than spending time looking, you know, on Google or on news sites or anything that's not powered by social media and social data. Spend more time asking questions on Facebook and on Twitter and, you know, wherever you're connected to people that you respect and know. That's where you're going to get that's where the salvation from this scattering is going to come from.
Well, that's
actually,
only if
let's move on to another question. Thank you very much. Over here.
You talked about all these tools creating more original thought because of the information that's available. But is there also not a risk that it really has the opposite and creates more of a convergence of thought? Mm-hmm. As I go on Google, and Google knows what I search, so it tends to serve me up things that it thinks I might like. Social media sites tend to serve me up things I might like. Advertisers get to know my background data, my demographic data, and serve me up things they think I might like. And eventually, it's the common points that rise to the top. And instead of creating a lot of original thinkers, it can create a reinforcement of...
Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not.
I'd recommend it. Because it's a really... It speaks to exactly what you're saying, is that you can have columns of areas of interest, and it's a free flow. There's no one controlling it. And that's what I love about Twitter, is that it feels like the one space where I have like columns on my screen and I am I'm following people that I find interesting and inventive and curious, and they're always turning me on to ideas and links to articles. Different than Facebook, you don't say I'm sitting on the beach on Twitter. You say, here's an interesting article. Like, I only follow people that are sending me links. So there's your Twitter. You just tweeted. Someone tweeted. I would recommend, if you'd like a new distraction for a little ADD, to try Twitter, because it speaks to what you're saying. And, of course, there is concern about the filter bubble. And I think these kind of conversations are really good, because we do need to be talking about this stuff. But ultimately, I believe in humans.
Yeah, because most of what's happening, I mean, is not on Twitter. It's people going out to the web looking for things, interacting. And, again, getting this demographic bubble shoved at them.
Maybe you should jump to page 30 on your search list and throw it all off.
Thank you.
So there was a lot of discussion about multitasking versus focus. And it seems a lot of it's rooted in the physiology of the brain. But there wasn't a lot of talk about personality type and how that factors into the choices we can make. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on how that plays a role.
Anybody want to talk?
I mean, no. I could, you know, there's one thing that's almost frequent, that's very frequently glossed over, is individual differences. Mm-hmm. As scientists, we love populations and big statistical effects of groups of people, but we're getting a lot more interested in individual differences now. We've been publishing on it recently, and there's a ton of rich, there's so much rich data in how people differ from each other. One thing that we see is that if you look at a population that does not work from our own lab, but work at a Stanford, if you look at a population of college students, there's very large differences in those that use media in this way and those that do not at all. Mm-hmm. You know, why that is still open-ended questions. The follow-up to that study was to look at that diversity and how people use their media and how they multitask, and then take them into the lab and do a series of cognitive tests and see how they perform on them. Mm-hmm. And what they found in that study was that the individuals that are the heavy media multitaskers tend to do worse on the type of cognitive abilities related to multitasking, like distractibility and switching, which is really interesting. Another chicken and egg problem, whether or not that's causing it, or do people that interact with the environment like that tend to multitask. Mm-hmm. But there are some really interesting differences, and we're just beginning to understand them now.
Actually, Adam, take a second just to describe you developed some video games, and we promised we would do that. Just what you're doing in your lab with multitasking. Yeah.
The training stuff?
So
a lot of our work has been on trying to understand the basic mechanisms by which you either successfully or unsuccessfully interact with multiple streams of information, whether it be distracting information or whether you're trying to multitask. And we know very clearly that it gets worse as you get older. And by older, I mean older than 20. So the, aging is a whole new field now.
Wow.
It's my job just got so much better, and I studied the entire population outside of 20-year-olds. But, you know, there was a time when it was like you thought everything was constant until you're 60, and then things change. And that's not how at least I think about it anymore. And now that we're getting a handle on the mechanisms and tools to study it, we're trying to design ways to improve the abilities to do this, to see can we take advantage of plasticity in our brain and improve our ability to rapidly switch between tasks or resist distraction if you want to, or try to actually multitask. Can we actually change our brain's bottlenecks and the limitations in it to allow that type of multiple channel processing? And so my lab and myself, I'm very interested in the use of video games, real immersive software that has had a lot of negative stigma, you know, a lot of negative associations. But there is recent data showing that video games, despite some of, you know, the violent aspects and a lot of things that gain a lot of negative attention, really improve amazingly attentional abilities in these children that use it. So there are clearly benefits, and if it could be channeled and used in the right way across any age group, maybe it can be used as a way to improve these abilities, especially if they're declining with age or another cognitive disorder. So we're actively interacting with companies and industry to see if we can use the principles that we study in our lab and validation, right? We just don't want to create things and get it out there. We want to figure out if they work with the same principles that we figure out if drugs work, and then use that as a way to improve these abilities.
Yeah, back to questions here. Actually, I think we're over here.
Hi. So I know that the brain is like a muscle. It's like it's something that you work out, like if you want to read to improve your memory and all those things. As a kid, kids have no filter. And I imagine that the filtering behavior kind of builds over time, but with what I call planet overshare now, with social networking sites, people are kind of escaping into losing that filter more and more. I'm kind of curious what the neurological perspective is on that, or what kind of implications that has. Additionally, how kind of having these platforms to say the things that they want to say somewhat anonymously online is affecting people's ability to actually communicate in person, like expressing how they actually feel to each other.
Yeah, so the first question, our front part of our brains, the prefrontal cortex, is the part, in many ways, that makes us most human. It's the part that allows us to control how we perceive things in the world. It allows us to control how we act in the world. And that part of our brain takes the longest to develop, well into the 20s. So we know it when you look at behaviors, and it gives what we study in our lab, which is called top-down control, your ability to guide your behavior, how you perceive, how you act based on your goals, not based on the environment, which is what animals, other than humans, are very, very responsive to the environment. And kids are also very responsive to the environment. They might have a goal. They could easily be redirected by something that's very salient or novel in their environment. And that develops as the prefrontal cortex connects to the rest of the brain, which is a slow process of myelination. How that development of the control processes, the filter, as you're calling it, which is appropriate, how that is affected by this is, I think, largely unknown. These are really hard studies to do the right way, which is actually to follow people over time in different groups that are controlled. It's really challenging, and a lot of this is just changing so rapidly. So there's lots of speculation, but it's important and interesting questions.
Anybody else have any comments on that? I think it's an important question, you know, how this information is coming to us. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but, you know, any filtering processes that people use?
Well, since all of our friends are above average, it's, you know, that's the ultimate filter. I'm not sure about the development piece, and I'm super interested in that because I've got kids, and, I am very keen on making sure that they have the ability to develop focusing skills.
Yeah, I think that's important.
As much as possible.
My new film is all on the brain. I'd love to talk to you more. But it's based on this work out of Harvard and University of Washington, where they're doing new imaging, 0 to 5, just even on children having social interaction, how much that helps their brain grow versus television or things where they're not physically in the room with someone. So I'm super interested in this next film. We'll hopefully delve into that.
Great. Quick question?
Sure. Hi, I'm curious to hear a little bit about what you all think the effects of all of this is on people's happiness levels, both in the short term on kind of a day-to-day basis and in the long term.
Well, I think the optimistic side of me is going to speak to you, is what, kind of what I said earlier. We're addicted to being connected to people. We're not addicted to our phone. We're addicted to connection. And that's our basic human fundamental aspect, is that we want to connect, and that's beautiful. And if we can, you know, like I unplug, I needed to do that because I wanted to connect in the old-fashioned way in addition to all these new ways. But I know I feel immense amount of happiness to be connected to my mother-in-law who lives back east and sending her little videos of the little moments with my kids. So I find that it definitely does if we set boundaries. So my answer is kind of, I think it's wonderful. I think we're creating this amazing level of oxytocin all over the world if we know when to turn it off.
We also like shiny things. Anyway, really quick question. We have less than a minute left.
Yeah, I'm curious, what's the difference between your brain multitasking that's my brain's telling me to stand up, to talk, to listen, to blink my eyes, and all these other kind of things as I talk to you now, versus looking at a screen and doing a Twitter or a smartphone?
You mean doing multiple of those things at a time?
Correct.
It's probably very similar. I'm not aware of anyone that's actually done studies. We've actually just talked about that in my lab this week, of trying to engage in more sort of what we call ecologically valid studies, where we're looking at the type of things that people actually do in their days. Most of us in the lab study, our experimental paradigms are pretty unnatural, and it's because they're very easier to control. But for the most part, you know, we live in a very multi-sensory world, and we are constantly changing between them, whether we're hearing or seeing. And how our brain responds is very much a product of the context that you're in, what type of information you're interacting with. Some people are way better in visual domain, auditory domain. It's a really good question, but it's a hard question to answer. It depends on what the things you're interacting with are. And it also depends on what your skill set is. And people could train themselves to be very good in a very specific type of multitasking or interaction, and it might not transfer to something else. We see that problem all the time when we try to develop brain training devices, that the ability to transfer, the generalization, is challenging. I don't know if that was an answer.
I'm going to cut you off there because we're almost finished. And Inforum now ends its discussions with a question. And we ask panelists to tell us in 60 seconds how they would change the world. Josh, you want to start?
Sure.
I was already tired.
I would... I would accelerate the end of one-way media delivery and basically stitch social capabilities into all media. I just think that the experience is better if you can connect with whatever it is you care about, whether it's politics, whether it's entertainment that you're into, whether it's even sports, whatever it is. It's more meaningful if there's a connection there, if you're actually able to reach back through whatever the medium is and touch the thing on the other side.
Great. Tiffany? Making you think here in the last...
No, it's like kind of two parts. One is I would want everyone to be connected, everyone to have access to the Internet, and then once you do, to unplug one day a week.
Good. Adam?
I think I would say that when I went through my medical education, I was very much affected by our focus on making people live longer. It seemed like a lot of times that was like the entire point, and it was complicated to me to think about that when it wasn't clear that people wanted to live longer. It just seemed like it was a strange goal in itself. So I would say that as from the medical community and even the development community in general to focus on quality mm-hmm. of life and those type of interventions. And I think the happiness question is interesting. I was thinking about it. It's like, how many people actually know what it's like when they feel happy? I mean, you really have to focus on that, right? Just pleasure is not really happy. And so I think if we start directing our interventions as, you know, from the medical community, even from the high-tech community, really focusing on things like quality and happiness, it'll have a, you know, very powerful impact.
Yeah, have more discussions like this, but regrettably, we've reached the end, and I would like you all to give a big round of applause to our panel. So it's Adam Ghazali, Tiffany Schlein, Josh McHugh, and we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum in the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.